Support for WPR comes from the Wisconsin DNR. Preventing food waste and composting scraps and uneaten veggies, grains, and fruit can help the environment. More dnr.wi.gov by searching food waste.
Time to take a look at the wonderful world of Wisconsin wildlife. Larry Mueller here, my guest Scott Craven, UW Extension wildlife ecologist. And if you have something that you wonder about relating to the wildlife here in our state, we hope you'll join in. Here's the number, 1-800-642-1234. Or in Madison at 263-1890, 263-1890. Give us a call with your questions and comments. And Scott, I'll be doing a little fishing coming up in a few days.
Well, good luck with that, Larry.
A musky fishing.
A lot of people participate in fall fishing, but I think the real push in the outdoors right now is people thinking about getting ready for or even participating in some of the early hunting seasons. And lots of folks are interested in the outlook for a variety of different game species. And, of course, fall weather's coming. Bird migration is already underway and will progress, and the weather's going to get better. I just hope it freezes soon to get rid of some of those mosquitoes.
Oh, it's awful.
Now, our northern listeners can't relate to that because I think it's still desperately dry in the north, but it is anything but dry around here.
You've got that right. And Ruth in Ladysmith is already with us with a question, so let's go to Ruth. Hi, Ruth. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. And I hope my daughter's not listening. couple weeks ago, I was in the basement in the evening, and I heard this scrabbling noise. So I went over and found that there were two bats in a pail, a big, deep pail. So I was really scared. I didn't know what to do. I grabbed a plastic bag, and I went over on my knees and flipped it over the top of the pail and got it so that I could hold the pail and took it outside and dumped it in the yard. And one flew away, and the other one didn't fly away right away, but I didn't stick around. I went in the house.
Mm-hmm.
So I was wondering, somebody told me that I read that bats, when they have rabies, they'll fall off their perches. However, somebody else said they can't climb up out of something like that. If they fall down, they have to be able to fall down to fly. So I was worried that they had rabies, and I was also worried about having bats in my basement. I've done everything I could to get rid of them, I think. I've sealed up any holes I found. I put mothballs. I put other things around, and I just want assurance that they probably weren't rabid.
Well, Ruth, you've touched on just about every conceivable aspect of the bat situation that we could have covered today. So let me start out by saying we can't tell you for certain that they weren't rabid. In fact, there was some recent publicity in the Madison papers in the State Journal that there had been a bit of a spike in rabies incidents in bats that had been tested in the area, five in the Madison area, I think, fairly recently, which is still not a large number, but it is a bit of an increase over previous years. The fact that you had a couple bats in the basement is not at all uncommon. I mean, lots of folks, especially in the month of August and into September, find bats in odd places. And that's a reflection of the fact that in August, the bat population is at its seasonal peak. Reproduction is over with, usually takes place in the months of June and July, which is why bat proofers and professionals who are excluding bats from homes generally don't do much bat work in June and July, if any, because of the risk of trapping flightless young bats in the home. So the bat exclusion and proofing work picks up again in August. But all those gazillions of young bats that have never flown before are all of a sudden airborne in the month of August. And as a result, there's a real spike in bats turning up in odd places and just lots of bat reports. And that could have certainly been what happened in your case, Ruth. But usually if there's a couple bats, the more bats you find, the more that indicates a bit of a trend, which would suggest that there's a likelihood that there were bats in your wall voids, in your attic, or some other common space in the house. You would only know that by either having prior experience with the bats in terms of hearing them in the walls or the attic or seeing some, or having a complete inspection made. If you went ahead and sealed up openings without taking steps to exclude them, then you may very well have trapped bats in those aforementioned spaces and actually made your situation a bit worse. Either because in their attempt to get out, they're more likely to find their way into your living space, or they'll die in the attic or wall void and create an additional problem. So I think you have to be a little bit cautious with that. And if you've just done this recently and you have any indication that you either hear or in the attic see bats, then I think you should reopen at least one major spot where they would have egress to the outside. As far as the two you found, you did the right thing in terms of evicting them and putting them outside. The fact that one remained on the ground, you know, it could have been a young bat that was an inexperienced flyer. But you were also correct in saying that when bats are rabid, they tend to fall down off their roost, become semi-paralyzed. And it's more common to encounter them on floors or driveways or basically on the ground than it is to encounter them behaving normally as bats normally would. So we touch on a lot of things there. I assume there'll be other calls about bats today, but bat-proofing is the way to solve the problem, and that can be done either now with the use of these one-way devices that the bat-proofers are using, or if you're relatively certain the bats leave your home, building, or whatever other structure after a good hard freeze in October and their food supply is eliminated in the form of flying insects, then the bat-proofing can be done then without the necessity to tinker with the one-way devices. You can just go ahead and seal up the openings. But with the bats still active, the fact that you sealed things up now could mean that you trapped more inside.
Could I add just a little bit more?
Sure.
After I took those other ones out, we did see some. My son saw some flying around down there a couple nights later, and we think maybe they were the same ones. So I opened up the dropped ceiling here and there, mm-hmm. and I turned on lights. I put lights up there to make it less cozy, mm-hmm. and I kept the lights on in the basement for like a week. So hopefully, you know, at night, hopefully making it less friendly for them in the morning when they want to come back and so forth. So we didn't see anything after the time when my son saw them and they disappeared. So mm-hmm. I hope they're gone.
Well, we can only hope for the best in your particular case, Ruth. And as far as the rabies issue, I think the recommendations on people seeking rabies treatment when exposed to bats have become a bit more conservative. And in the past, it was most often triggered by a known bite. But now there's some comment in this newspaper article that the health officials are recommending the consideration, at least, of rabies treatment, even with exposure, if a bite can't be ruled out. It strikes me in terms of what you described that you're okay. But mm-hmm. I think that's really a decision that has to be made between you and your family doctor.
Thanks, Ruth, and good luck to you. Thank you very much for calling. Want to move on to some other callers here. Annette in Wauwatosa is next. Hi, Annette. Thank you for calling.
Hi, you're welcome. I'm wondering if humans are in danger from coyotes. I had one in my yard.
My direct answer and the big picture answer would be no, but on a smaller scale, certainly in some parts of the country, not necessarily Wisconsin, there have certainly been records of attacks of coyotes on humans, particularly children, and particularly where the coyotes have been habituated to people, either by someone feeding them or by them simply living in close proximity to humans over time. So I can't rule out the possibility that there's some risk, but it's certainly a very low risk. I mean, there are lots and lots of coyotes around. There are lots and lots of coyotes in close proximity to people, even though most people never see them, or even when they see them may dismiss them as just a stray dog. Unless the coyote was in some way threatening or you felt it just approached, you know, within your comfort zone, Annette, I don't know as there's much to be concerned with. You may not see it again.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Annette. Kirk and Franklin, your turn now. Hi, Kirk.
Hi. I was wondering your thoughts on installing a bat house and how it would affect maybe the mosquito population.
Mm-hmm. Well, a bat house is always a good idea, I think, Kirk, in general. Not only do you potentially provide some housing for bats, which might in fact be a few less bats that might be in Ruth's or someone else's home, but you have the benefit of being able to watch them. They're interesting little animals. Their flying abilities are amazing, and they certainly do eat lots of flying insects. Whether or not you'll detect detect is the key thing. An appreciable change in the mosquito population, I think, is arguable. Certainly in a night's feeding, bats eat hundreds and hundreds of insects on an individual basis. And they do eat some mosquitoes and some other bugs, but they also eat a lot of beetles and moths and other night-flying insects. So let's put it this way. The bat house is a good idea on its own merits. Whether it's going to be a detectable change in insect control remains to be seen. But they certainly will eat some bugs.
Yeah, definitely. But, another question is, if I was to install a bat house, mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure how do you do it? I know that you have to get, like, a guano or something like that to attract the bats.
Not necessarily. First of all, you need to pick a design that you're happy with. And it could be anything from a small colony box that mounts on the side of the house to a very large box that might sustain a colony of hundreds or even thousands of bats that you might mount on a large pole in the middle of a big open yard or park. So you have to decide the scale that you want to work here. Assuming it's just the average kind of homeowner-style bat box that might accommodate anywhere from a dozen or two to 50 or 100 bats, and you can either build them or buy them commercially, then it's a matter of proper placement. And generally speaking, again, the side of a building is a good spot, but you want it high enough so that it can't be tampered with. You want it on an exposure where it gets some warmth and is out of prevailing wind to make it more attractive to the bats. And you certainly don't want to place it over your patio or deck or front door because they're designed to allow the bat droppings or guano to freely fall from the house. And you don't want that stuff raining down on your patio area. So those are the considerations on a house. Generally speaking, I'd say a building is probably the best site, followed closely by a pole in the open. And the last choice would be a tree. What might seem like a good spot, oh, there's a nice straight tree, I'll put my bat house up there, is not going to be particularly attractive compared to the other sites because the tree allows access to a variety of predators that might get after the bats, and the bats don't particularly care for the foliage. They prefer to be in the open.
Mm-hmm. Good luck. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. If you'd like to join in, the number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or if you're in Madison, reach us at 263-1890. Talking about wildlife today with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, and we have open lines. We can get you on pretty quickly. I'm Larry Mueller, Jim Packard, our producer, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking the world of wildlife with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Scott, I wanted to mention, I mentioned I was going fishing, but really tomorrow I will be in Manitowish waters and we'll be talking fishing and we'll be talking lake ecology with, we've got four guests and we're really looking forward to it. Joe Booker, a famous fishing guide, will be one of our guests. And that's on from 11 to 12:30 tomorrow at the Manitowish Waters Community Center Pavilion. Really looking forward to having a chance to meet people. And if you would like to join us at the Manitowish Waters Community Center Pavilion, I hope you'll do it. It's from 11 to 12:30 tomorrow. It's free. Come. The doors open at 10 o'clock. I'll be there talking to people. And at 11 o'clock, we start the show. And it'll end at 12:30. And you can be on your way, and so will we. And I'll probably be fishing after that, or maybe fishing. Maybe that might be, or maybe golf. You never know. But I'll
choices,
be fishing.
Choices.
I'll be fishing. Actually, I'll be fishing the World Muskie Championship that weekend, and we'll be talking about that Muskie Championship on the show as well. So that's tomorrow, Thursday, September 6th, 11 to 12:30 at the Manitowish Waters Community Center. And Mike in Oregon, your turn next. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
Scott, I'm your neighbor. I can see your house from where we live.
Okay.
And between you and me, it's pretty exposed.
Mm-hmm.
I have tried two bat houses since we moved out here 8 years ago. I put them both on trees, and I can testify they do not work on trees. Problem with a pole where we live, in that sort of that is between your house and mine,
mm-hmm.
it's really exposed. All the wind would catch a pole.
Mm-hmm.
I could put it on the back of the house, but the back of the house or back of the garage. The garage is just one story. Is that high enough for a bat house?
Well, you know, it's a little low, but Mike, bat houses are a bit like bird houses in that sometimes the birds make some strange choices, and the bats might surprise you as well. So I think if you've had a complete lack of success with the tree issue or the pole issue isn't going to work, you have to play the hand you're dealt and play out your options and see what happens. Realistically, in that open area out there, although I have a couple bat houses, in fact, I was fumbling with one in the shop last night thinking, what am I going to do with this thing? I think I'm actually going to take it up north because I've just, it's unusual to see a bat foraging or around the house there in the open in the evening. So I've just not felt I had much potential there, and I've kept the houses down. The only other thing you can do besides tinkering with the placement is to seed the house a bit with a little bat guano, as an earlier caller alluded to. You know, a tablespoon of bat guano in a little mesh bag and thumbtacked up into the house may help a little bit, but there's no guarantee.
Okay. Is facing east a good idea to catch the morning sun?
They prefer sun over wind, so east, south, southeast, or southwest are better than northwest or north.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha.
All right, Mike. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And Chuck in Boscobel, let's go to you next. Hi, Chuck.
Hello. Yes, I had a question about deer population. I live in a rural area near Boscobel in Marion Township, northern Grant County, and we've had pretty heavy hunting around here, and I just wonder what the population is doing at this point.
Well, Chuck, I guess let me start out with the big picture and just say that overall the deer population statewide is in terrific shape. You know, I shouldn't say that. From the hunter's perspective, maybe terrific shape. From the perspective of the DNR, way too many. So the estimate for the herd of 1.6 to 1.8 million, in spite of over 500,000 being killed last year by hunters, that the herd continues to stay very high. Now, having said that, there are certainly many places in the state, while they're overpopulated, there are other places in the state where deer are reasonably scarce. That's just the way their distribution is on the landscape. But on balance, given the number of deer management units that are under Earn-a-Buck regulations this year or in the CWD, the Chronic Wasting Disease Management Zones, or other considerations, there are relatively few areas where people would consider deer populations light or even at management goals. Down in the southwest where you are, chronic wasting disease hunting pressure, longer seasons, very liberal bag limits, DNR sharpshooter harvest up until this year have reduced the herd in some areas but had relatively little impact in others. And overall, I think the information that was gleaned from the helicopter surveys last winter would suggest that populations in most of the chronic wasting disease management areas, in spite of that liberal hunting pressure and opportunity, have rebounded to approximate pre-CWD levels in some parts of the landscape. There are some sections, for example, that were counted in the winter that had very high populations of deer. There were other sections, meaning a square mile, that had none whatsoever. Now, they'll certainly relocate a little bit with the fall and normal deer movement patterns, but there is still a lot of deer out there overall on the landscape.
What would you say would be a high number of deer? You said a high number for a square mile.
They had square miles where there were over 100 deer counted within a square mile. And others, as I said, with zero and, you know, a lot in between. So there was, it was all over the spectrum, and there certainly weren't many that exceeded 100, but there were sections that exceeded 100 deer per square mile, even in this area where it's been basically scramble competition for hunting for the last five seasons. It's pretty amazing, actually.
My experience recently has been to see fewer deer, but the anecdotal evidence is that there's sure plenty around here in northern Grant County.
Well, there are other things going on there too, Chuck. Yes, there are some areas where they've been thinned out pretty heavily. There are others where they're very abundant. But deer are quite adaptable, and I think they've been under such pressure recently with the kinds of hunting seasons we've had that they've become a bit more nocturnal. They've certainly become a lot more jumpy, which you'd only expect. So there are some other issues in just sightability and ability to get close to them or hunt them, in addition to whether they're simply there or not.
Yeah. The other question has to do with bear.
somebody, I didn't see this myself, but somebody reported a bear in a field nearby here in Grant County, mm-hmm. and I think that would be kind of unusual. Have there been other sightings in this area?
Yes, most assuredly. And it is unusual, but it's not unheard of. And there are various responses. In some cases, it generates a great deal of public attention. In other cases, the landowners where the bears are seen become rather protective and quiet about it, and nothing gets out unless the bear happens to be seen in the open. But I have no doubt but what there are some bears in southwestern Wisconsin.
Yeah. Well, from my point of view, that's a good thing.
Okay.
Thanks a lot for calling. By the way, the bear season is just opening, and what's the outlook for bear hunters?
Looks pretty good. Not if you didn't get a permit. I think there were 80,000, I've got that somewhere here, but somewhere around 80,000 applicants for permits this year, about 4,400 plus or minus a few permits. So a lot of people didn't get one. Some of the season, I think the season is zoned and by technique, but there were some openings this morning. Bear populations estimated around 13,000. I think the success rate last year was somewhere in the neighborhood of 70%. So a high proportion of those 4,400 plus people who got a permit will get a bear. So, but in perspective, you know, we're talking 13,000 bears and 1.7 million deer. You know, obviously the bears are a little fewer and farther between than the deer are.
Judy in Ridgetown, your turn now. Judy, hi.
Hi. I'm sorry to be a killjoy about the bats, but I think you ought to have some additional information. When somebody in my house was very ill, we didn't notice, but the bat population in our attic really proliferated. We never had bats in the house, but there got to be so many bats that they carry a little parasite, which is a tick, but it's a soft tick. It's not like the tick you guys usually see out the woods.
Right.
It
yeah.
migrated down into the house, and it carries, if you look on the internet, a number of diseases. And what I got from my spectacular tick bite, which I watched happening, was ehrlichiosis.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a reportable disease like Lyme's, and it's just about as devastating as Lyme's can be when it's not diagnosed right away and treated. So I just would like you guys to be alert. There is a nasty little bug that lives with, especially these were big, large brown bats. They're not very mm-hmm. big. Also, I finally got them excluded from the house, and they moved to the tobacco shed. So if anybody wants free guano, there's no way I can kick them out of the shed. I got it by the gallon.
Well, wow. I mean, we happen to be talking about rabies because that's what we were asked about, but there's no question that there are many reasons, and many other diseases and problems why you wouldn't want to share your house with bats, whether they're parasites or whether they're fungal problems on the droppings left in the attic or rabies or the smell or the sound or a whole host of other reasons. So, you know, for the folks who are interested in bat houses, that's fine, but for the folks who are victimized by bats in a building, as several callers today have been, get them out of there.
Yep, get them out of there. That's right. Judy, thank you very much. Ed in Burlington, your turn. Hi, Ed.
Hi. We have been staying out at Camp Post out by Richard Bong State Park, down in southeast Wisconsin. And the mosquito population is, like everyone knows, really high. But lately I've been seeing quite a few goldfinches that have been young fledglings that have been dying, and I was just wondering if that might have something to do with the mosquito population.
That they would harass or bite them to the point that they died?
Well, that's a good question, Ed. I'm not sure I can speculate on that. Where have you seen these fledgling goldfinches, and what kind of numbers are you talking about?
Well, we feed them here right at our site, and I picked one up this morning. And there was one out there about 2 days ago, and we seen one that was kind of hobbling around about a week ago. So, I mean, it's just been lately that this has been going on.
Yeah.
Now, the one that was hobbling around, we, you know, never did find it, and it went out in the weeds. But these other two were right at our campsite, and they're both American goldfinches, fledgling, young ones.
Yeah. Well, it seems like they're good.
Later in the year.
There's been pretty good goldfinch activity lately at a lot of people's feeders, and they're of course, quite visible and a popular feeder visitor. But there are so many things that could affect those. All birds all could have been part of the same brood, for that matter, and been affected by who knows what. I'm reluctant to, when you see something in the environment like the number of mosquitoes we see, and then find something else. It's the linkage is possible, of course, but mm-hmm. I think it's just human nature and a tendency to try and make that connection when there's really no other evidence to go on. So short of having those dead birds tested or looked at to see if other disease concerns could be ruled out, or if there's some evidence that they were, you know, covered with bites or literally sucked dry, I guess, by excessive mosquito numbers, I don't think we can make that connection, but I can't rule it out either, Ed.
Mm. Thanks for calling, Ed. Appreciate it. Kelly and Racine, you are next. Hi, Kelly.
Hi. Well, I don't have a mosquito or a bat question. It might be a question better for tomorrow, but I have a 4-year-old son, and he's really interested in learning how to fish and fishing, and I have no idea what to do when you fish. So I was wondering, is there some place or classes, or how do I learn to fish so we can fish together, is my question.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are lots of possibilities, Kelly. One thing to consider, especially perhaps, you said he was 4?
Yeah.
Yeah, so maybe a little young, but I'm thinking there are certainly 4-H clubs throughout the state, and 4-H has a fishing project to initiate young children into fishing and then move up through the ranks. The DNR has an angler education program, and they provide workshops and opportunities all over the state. And I think the other thing, there are local sportsmen's groups that sponsor teaching kids fishing here at Tenney Park, Larry, and
in
other
Madison.
Places in different communities. So I would first go talk to find your local DNR office and talk to either the fish manager or someone else in the office who deals with public information and education, see what they can offer in the area, and then ask them where some of the local sportsmen's groups are in the Racine area and see there who you can find. And even if you don't find an organized program for a child of that age, I'm guessing if you just get your request before any local sportsman's or fishing group and say, gee, here's someone who's trying to get their child interested in fishing, I'm guessing you're going to come up with a mentor pretty easily and mm-hmm. someone who will, you know, take the
teach
child out or teach him what to do, or maybe get you interested in fishing too.
But it sounds like you want to go too, Kelly.
Yeah, well, I thought that would be something good. I have no interest in hunting. I don't do sports. I thought, well, okay, maybe I could handle fishing if I can get over the whole cleaning the fish thing. I could probably do it.
So well, you know, you can always let them go so and avoid the cleaning issue, but people can help you with that too. That's not that big a deal.
Okay.
But I'd start with the DNR office. Check with your local sportsmen's groups. Who else are we missing, Larry? 4-H, the 4-H agent.
He's a little young for 4-H, but...
Yeah, but the 4-H agent might be able to steer some of their volunteer leaders who, again, might be willing to help out one-on-one. I think you just don't know where the help is going to come from, but there are lots of possibilities.
I have a 4-year-old as well, and I think what any of these people would probably tell you is that for a 4-year-old, they're interested in catching some fish. You'd want to go someplace where the panfish are there. It doesn't make any difference to them, the kids, how big the fish is. Just that they catch some, take a pail with you so you can put some of the fish in the pail that they can watch them, and a pail of water that they can watch them. I've been fortunate enough to take my daughter out to places where we can catch fish, every 5 seconds, one bites. And that's the kind of the situation I think that's great for a 4-year-old. I think anybody from DNR or anybody else would tell you the same thing.
And as a last resort, I guess, the self-taught option is also a possibility. Even if you can't find an immediate mentor, get the 4-H literature on youth fishing or the DNR angler ed information on starting fishing. And the equipment is very inexpensive for kind of
very
an
cheap
entry-level rod and reel, a bobber, a couple hooks, and a few worms, and boy, you're ready to go.
And the only other spot that you might look for is to go to a local bait shop
Or a big sporting goods store.
Or a big, yeah, big sporting goods store. Or a, if there's a local bait shop in your area that you can go and just talk to the people about where to go once you have some information, just to catch a few fish, and he's going to like it. And so will you.
Thank you so much for information, gentlemen. Thanks a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks, Kelly. Thanks a lot for calling. Good luck. I'm glad to hear that you want to get your son fishing, and I'm glad to hear that he wants to fish. Mm-hmm. It's a great activity. Great family activity. Bill in De Pere, it's your turn. Hi, Bill.
Good morning. I have a small, about a three-quarter acre pond on my property, and about early July, a single duckling showed up. No hen, no sibs, no nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought quite literally he was a dead duck, but as a matter of fact, he did survive, and it was really funny to see him learning to fly. He'd go, you know, flapping across the pond, mm-hmm. and finally one day he got up and got away. The question is, you know, what's the scenario? How did that single little duck get there, and how did he survive?
Well, we know how he survived. He simply was able to find food and grow, mm-hmm. and you know, a lot of that's instinct. It's not necessarily taught by the female. How it got there is anybody's guess. I could imagine a brood moving through, and the brood could have been decimated by who knows what, and down to a duckling or two or three ducklings, and that one simply got left behind. The rest of the brood made it up over the dam or over the curb or through the woods, and that one didn't for whatever reason. Or it did get there with the parent, and then something befell the parent bird. But one way or the other, it was orphaned, and you've got a success story in your hands in that it made it to flight stage and left. So it's a good news situation, but the survival issue is based on instinct. And in a pond like that where you apparently didn't have any big snapping turtles to do it in and nothing else got it, it was, I guess we'd have to call it the lucky duckling.
Yeah. The lucky duck.
Yeah, I have one other question.
Yeah.
Yesterday I was working outside, and I right at the tip of Green Bay. Actually, I was a bit inland, and hundreds of cormorants came by. Are they migrating yet?
They're still active there. If you're at the southern tip of Green Bay, the big colony at Cat Island, that flies to and from up and down the bay by Longtail Point, and then up the river, up the Fox River. There are several thousand birds there in that colony, and I think those are probably still mostly local birds flying around, with the population buoyed by the reproduction, and the young are now on the wing as of August, and those are local birds, but they will start, more birds will be coming and going soon.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Nick in Green Bay, hi to you.
Hi. I just had a quick question. I used to live up in Gwynn, Michigan, which is just rural Michigan.
Yep.
And I had the black lab tied out, and a wolf approached them, and I came outside and saw the whole thing, and she took off. She never looked back, but I was just kind of curious what her intent was.
Probably no good.
Probably no good from the standpoint of the dog. I mean, it could, like any other animal, wolves are curious, but approaching a dog, you know what? There are really only three possibilities. It was curious and just checking things out. It was intent on doing it bodily harm. Or it was considering mating with it. Those are the three options. And we really can't, with a short of an interview with the wolf, we're never going to know.
Well, when I came outside, it was about 4 feet from it, from a dog. So it was neat to see.
But, if it was that close and there'd been no, you know, hostile growling or attack or whatnot, I think its intentions were either curiosity or just exploring the possibilities.
Now, is that usual to have one wolf, just a lone wolf like that? Or I thought they were in packs.
Well, they usually are, but certainly as they disperse, especially young ones, which is why the curiosity factor may have come in, I mean, they can cover tremendous distances alone and on their own. I mean, we've had records of the Wisconsin wolves turning up all over the southern part of the state, down in Illinois and Indiana. Yeah, the one a few years ago that left central Wisconsin and ultimately died in a motor vehicle accident, almost to the Ohio line in eastern Indiana. And that's a long trip through a lot of hurdles, and that wolf probably passed a lot of dogs along the way. So they get around.
Yep. Thanks a lot for calling. Sue and Wausau is next, and I hope our previous caller, the lady who called about her 4-year-old son, is still listening, because we've got a few callers with some fishing ideas
here, excellent.
And Sue and Wausau is one of them. Hi, Sue.
Hi.
I had another idea. Cub Scouts is a good place to go young boys. Boy Scouts as they get older, but Cub Scouts when they're at five years old is when they can start.
Okay.
Yeah. And then also, if she's interested in learning how, there's an organization that's actually headquartered out of UW Stevens Point called
Becoming an Outdoors Woman.
Yeah, and that's a good place. I actually attended it once myself, and it's a great place for her to learn.
Very good tips. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you.
You know, I've got three, you know, I've daughters, you know, I never thought about Cub Scouts. No son. Scott and Eau Claire, hi to you.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Just talking about with the kids, fish and stuff. I belong to a local bass chapter, around the Eau Claire Chippewa area. And every year in the spring and the fall, we work with the Big Brothers, Big Sisters, and we take out, kids fishing. We go to Shields and Shields helps us out, and they all get outfitted with their own rod, reel, tackle box, and all that. And they think it's pretty fun to go out in our big bass boats and everything. And just kind of want to let you know that Big Brothers, Big Sisters is a good way to introduce kids. And also, if any other, you know, people are listening that belong to the bass clubs, it's a good way to give back, you know.
Yep.
That's a great idea.
Absolutely great idea. Do you ever take out a parent along with them, Scott?
Oh, yeah, the parents are encouraged to come along if they like.
Okay, good. Good. So that's another way to learn then.
For the listeners not familiar with the Shields, is a big sporting goods store. And as I'm thinking about the Racine area, I think there's a big Bass Pro store right down there along 43 in either Racine or Kenosha County, and that would be a good place for her to pay a visit to.
Another good idea. Thanks, Scott.
You bet.
Appreciate it. Jack in Waukesha, your turn. Hi, Jack.
Hi there. 100 years ago, the Whitefish Bay Recreation Department, with their adult recreation programs, had a bait casting club in the high school swimming pool. Now, almost all bait casters would be fishermen, of course, so she should check with the Racine adult recreation people to see if they have that kind of a program. Those people could certainly send her to the right spot.
That's a good, another good tip.
And Racine is a major port for fishing on Lake Michigan. I assume that charter fishing captains have an association, and who knows, maybe they get somebody on a slow day to take Kelly and her son out on a Lake Michigan boat. There are all sorts of possibilities. I hope she's lucky enough to follow up with a few of them.
And just on back to Cub Scouts for a minute, you do have to be in first grade in order to be a Cub Scout. But still, the information that they give, you could probably get from the Cub Scout organization. Back to that one. Thanks, Jack. Appreciate your call. And appreciate your calls as well. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. We're talking wildlife today with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking wildlife today with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Let's go back to the phones and to David in Dresser. Hi, David. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
As a fisherman myself, I would really like to see that young boy get a chance to learn to fish. And if she's involved with any local community groups or church groups in her church, I bet there's a wealth of gentlemen there that would love to teach a young boy and herself how to fish.
That's a very good idea as well. Thank you, David. You know, we thought we'd covered most of the territory, Scott, but we obviously didn't. And it's always nice to get calls and comments, and you're right. If you've belonged to a church.
When you stop thinking about the level of participation in Wisconsin in fishing, I hear what we sell, a million fishing licenses, something like that.
Yeah.
I mean, the odds are pretty good that Kelly's next-door neighbor on one side or the other probably fishes.
Yeah.
So.
And Sue in Caledonia, we'll go to you next. Hi, Sue.
Hey, good morning.
Morning.
I'm hoping you can identify a pair of animals that my husband saw a couple weeks ago.
We'll try.
I hope so. We're just south of Franklin, and it's a rural area, but there are houses there. He was coming home from work about midnight, and he saw a pair of animals running up the drive. He said, bigger than raccoons, kind of more of a ferret shape. He said the thing that came to mind was wolverines. I don't know if that's possible. Does that sound like anything?
Not possible. Might be badger, do you think?
You have any? Bigger than a raccoon, but more ferret-like. You mean short legs, a kind of a waddling gait? What else did he say?
Well, he should be the one talking to you. But longer legs, a little bit longer, and a ferret shape, like a longer tail.
Sounds like a pair of otters. It sounds like a pair of otters to me.
Yeah.
Would they be that big?
Sure. They're quite a bit longer than a raccoon. It's a good-sized animal. Did he describe the color? Were they dark in color?
He said they were dark, yeah.
Okay, then I'm guessing if he described them as being ferret-like or weasel-like, it was probably a pair of otters.
That's a very good guess. Very good guess.
Okay, wolverines didn't sound like anything we'd have nearby.
We have none in Wisconsin.
That's about as likely as hippopotamus.
Okay. All right, thanks. Thanks for calling. Appreciate your call, Sue. Ed in Burlington. It's your turn. Hi, Ed.
Hi. Yeah, calling back. The 4-year-old that wants to go fishing.
Yeah.
Richard Bong State Recreation Area in Kenosha. They have the fishing poles here and the bait, and they have all the equipment, and they have the urban fishing pond, and it is all free to any child 16 years or younger, and then they can be accompanied by an adult.
There you go.
I think it's like a $20 deposit for all the equipment, and then you get the money back when you bring all the equipment back.
Oh, perfect.
Perfect. Ed, now you made us feel bad we couldn't solve your goldfinch problem earlier.
Thanks, Ed. Thanks a lot for calling. All right. The Bong area. Brian in Appleton, your turn. Hi, Brian.
Good morning, guys. I have a very quick question here concerning I used to live in Wausaukee, which is about 10 miles north of Cribbets, Wisconsin, and we lived out in the country. And one day I went out to go and get my mail, and as I walked out there, I saw this creature, black, long tail, rounded ears. I thought it was a fox as it ran across the road. But that entire evening, my wife and I had our windows open to let the breeze through, and we heard this woman screaming in the woods, and we're thinking, is somebody being assaulted or whatever? And then I saw that creature the next day with this long tail that ran across the road. The mystery that basically kept us, well, what was that? Was it a fox or whatever? We screen printed T-shirts, and the Bobcat and Coyote Hunters Club, we were making some T-shirts for them, and we delivered them, and he had a stuffed one of these things, and he called it a fisher.
Mm-hmm.
What can you tell me about a fisher screaming like a woman? That's what he told me, was that they make a very high-pitched woman like screaming. Is that true or not? I've always wanted to have this question answered.
Well, when you describe a dark, long-tailed animal, there are limited possibilities. Mm-hmm. Fisher is certainly one of them. So if you saw the mounted fisher and said, aha, that's what I saw, then that's what you saw. And they're a northern animal for the most part, although there have been recent records into the southern part of the state. They're a member of the weasel family, so they're about otter-sized, but they're not an aquatic animal. They're a terrestrial animal. Dark in color, they have kind of a loping gait. They were extirpated for a while and then reintroduced to Wisconsin 40 or 50 years ago, and they've done very well. And their populations boomed in the northern part of the state and have actually begun to subside a little bit. So I don't question that you perhaps saw a fisher. The fact that you saw a fisher the next day or the day before and heard the screaming doesn't necessarily mean to me that that was the animal doing the screaming. There are lots of animals.
Owls?
Ranging from barred owls, as Larry suggests, to a variety of mammals that can make some pretty bizarre sounds. I've spent a lot of time in the North Woods and just finished a 1-year stint up on the shores of Lake Tomahawk, and there are quite a few fisher on that property, and I can't say that I've ever heard a sound in the woods that I would have attributed to a fisher. I actually thought, my impression was, they, like most members of the weasel family, are pretty quiet for the most part. Now, that's not to say they can't make a scream, but I don't know under what circumstances they would do so. I see Larry's looking at our Sounds of Wildlife CD, but I don't imagine a fisher's on there.
Fisher's not in here. I was looking.
And I imagine if you look, there are probably no other weasels represented there either because they're relatively quiet. So you know, I'm not sure what the trapper might have heard or knew, and there are plenty of people out there more familiar in the North Woods with fishers than I am, so we may generate another call here. But I was not aware of the fact that they were very vocal. But there are other explanations for the sound, even if you did see a fisher.
Yep.
Well, all that evening, it kept us awake for hours, and but it came on such a regular interval that we realized this is not a 1 minute or 2 minute assault that's happening in the woods, and it kept up and it was loud. And then I saw that creature the next day, and months later, when we delivered that box of T-shirts, that's exactly what he said. He said they scream. It sounds just like a woman in distress.
Mm. Well, we'll see if we can get some other feedback on that. It's certainly possible. No question that you saw the fisher, Brian. That seems obvious in this case. But whether it's connected to the sound or not is another matter.
Thanks a lot for calling, Brian. Appreciate it. I want to get Angie online here in Oshkosh. Angie, hi to you.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
I'm calling about a raccoon. It was a rabid raccoon that's been living around our house, and animal control tried to track it, and it tracked it down a couple blocks. Will it come back to my house where it was apparently feeding?
What kind of a raccoon did you call
rabid.
It? Rabid. And how do you know it was rabid?
It was out in the day. It was all hunched up. It was trying to chase some people, and it was foaming at the mouth.
Okay. Oh. Well, it's far more likely with something else other than rabies, like canine distemper or whatnot. The only way you could confirm rabies is to actually have it tested. So okay. I don't think you should necessarily panic about the notion that you had a rabid raccoon. Raccoon rabies, while common east of Wisconsin, is not possible, but not especially common here in the state. But there are lots of other diseases that affect raccoons. Bottom line is, if the animal's gone, there's no way to predict where it is or what might have happened to it. If it was that ill and behaving strangely, there's a pretty good chance it went off somewhere and died.
How long does it take if they had, like, the distemper to die?
I have no idea, because I have no idea what stage it was in when you saw it. But it would not be a long time.
No.
Okay. So my speculation here would be that, okay, you saw a sick raccoon. We don't know what it was affected by, but it was obviously sick. It's disappeared. I think there's a very good chance that it's dead and gone.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
All right. Thanks for calling. Holly in Elm Grove, your turn. Hi, Holly.
Good morning. Hi, Larry. Hi, Scott.
Hello.
This is a mouse in the house question.
Okay.
Mouse in the house. Okay.
Got a place up north, very well insulated. Do everything I can to make sure that there aren't invitations all over for mice to want to come in, but they somehow come in. Mm-hmm. They bring the sunflower seeds with them, and they stash them all over the place along with the, and I hate to say this, the decon. I have little turquoise piles of decon all stashed under pillows, between pillows, under sheets, under mattresses, in the linen closet, along with an occasional sunflower seed.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is this a health problem? Am I overdoing it with, oh, God, I got to wash all this stuff again?
You mean, is it a health problem because there's decon scattered around?
No, not
or the mice?
The presence of the mice, because the mice leave their presence.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the likely mice involved there are the little white-bellied, white undersurface of the tail, deer mice or white-footed mice, whatever you want to call them. They all belong to the same biological genus, but they're a couple different species. But they're notorious cachers of food like that, and they're notorious invaders of cabins. Keeping them out of even the most well-sealed home or cabin is a Herculean task. They'll find a way in. But I think if you want to, A, get rid of them, and B, make sure you know what you have, you're a whole lot better off going with traps than decon.
Okay.
A few well-positioned mouse traps or sticky traps, glue boards, if you prefer that term, will catch them pretty readily, as long as you're up there occasionally to empty the traps.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, a decomposing mouse presents its own problems. But I think that will confirm for you what you have, and it gives you a little bit more immediate feedback of, aha, I got him, or you hear the trap and then remove the mouse, as opposed to the decon, which if they're not eating it immediately, if they're caching it, you may be accomplishing nothing by putting out an anticoagulant like that, because they have to consume a regular quantity of it for 6 or 7 or 8 days before they get a lethal dose. Just eating some of it for a day or two won't do anything to them, which is why I suggest you might want to go to the traps, especially when you're actually there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Good luck.
I appreciate it.
Yep, okay. Thanks a lot for calling. Dan in Presque Isle, your turn. Hi, Dan.
Hey, good morning. Hey, thanks for these wonderful programs, and I look forward to seeing you tomorrow.
Great.
Here in Presque Isle. So we'll see you at Manitouish Waters.
Wonderful.
What I'm after is, hi, Scott, too. to make fishing a little easier for a beginner or for little kids, my grandkids, I've always taken to squash the barb on a hook. It sure makes putting a fish back in the lake a lot easier. And if they get it caught in their finger, it comes out a little easier, too.
Yeah.
Good idea. Barbless hook.
Barbless hook, and it's a good idea. And if you're returning the fish to the water, it's an excellent idea because you're not going to damage the fish as much either. So, Dan, I appreciate that. And Kelly's had lots of good advice here as she had her question about how to work with her young 4-year-old on learning to fish. Thanks again very much for calling. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking the wonderful world of wildlife now with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, Larry Mueller here. Thanks for listening in. Lots of people online. You can join us at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Let's turn to Shirley in Pepin. Shirley, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for having me. Yeah, it's been fun listening to your program. It caused me to remember that I've been looking for some information about that it has to do with our live trapping. We've got some pests outside, and the rabbits and raccoons are invading our gardens quite a bit. And when we live trap them, we had a discussion about how far you have to take them before they won't come back. And I just don't know.
Well, the guidelines suggest that for most kind of urban, suburban wildlife pests, squirrels, rabbits, raccoons, and so forth that are going to be relocated is a minimum of 5 miles. And if you can cross either a major river or a highway a couple of times, that's even better within that 5 miles, meaning that will minimize their chances of successful return. Rabbits certainly less distance than raccoons. Rabbits just don't have much of a home range or movement capability compared to raccoons. But the real question, surely, is whether relocation of these animals is in the best interest of the people whose land they now reside on, mm-hmm. or the animals themselves. So there's a great deal of controversy around the country in whether live trapping and relocation is really the humane solution to some of these problems that people think it is. I realize it's attractive because you can let the animal go somewhere and, hey, it's out of sight, out of mind. It'll probably live happily ever after here in somebody else's backyard or somebody else's rural property. But in reality, you've moved the animal from its home range where it knows where shelter, food sources, water, and other things are into a foreign environment, which is probably already saturated with rabbits and raccoons, and it may just end up in somebody else's garden or chimney or basement or whatever. Mm. So I guess what I'm suggesting is a lot of people do this. If you have permission for a release site, you're fine. But in reality, some type of humane euthanasia of some of these species may be in the long run preferable to the relocation.
Now, yep. Thanks for calling, Shirley. Appreciate it. Sue in Oconto County, it's your turn. Hi, Sue.
Hi, Scott. Hi, Larry.
Hi.
Scott, I'm one of your coverts.
Oh, great.
I have a bear question for you today.
Okay.
Just a little update on the history of the area. We had a bear attack on a horse several years ago, probably about 3 or 4. I don't know if you remember that incident or not. And then recently we have had sightings of sows with 4 cubs.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I thought that was pretty unusual and probably not all hers. But then we were talking to another friend that happens to live in the Wilbino area, and he said there's a sow up there with 4 cubs.
Mm-hmm.
And we also found out during the course of conversation with more neighbors that one of the local neighbors is also feeding the sow and 4 cubs. And I'm wondering if it's possible that they could have had 4 cubs or if she's paired up with another sow and we just never saw her, or what, if this is likely to be a problem or not also.
Four is a possibility.
Well, four is a possibility. I mean, it could be a case of usurping or adopting a couple other cubs of the same age, but it's also, it's certainly at the upper end of the distribution of litter size, but it does happen. Mm-hmm. And we've had lots of reports over the years of that. So that's a possibility. There's no reason to think that simply because the sow has three or four cubs as opposed to one or two, that it's more likely to be a problem bear or a problem with the cubs. The problem's far more likely to be because somebody's feeding the animals and therefore habituating them to people and convincing them, especially the cubs, that a person or a back door or a dog dish or a barn or anything else means food. That's where the problems are more likely to come in. I'm not sure what the linkage between the horse attack a few years ago. Were you particularly interested in a certain bear, or were you thinking there was some recurring threat of that happening?
Well, I think what's happening is exactly what you just talked about. We have people feeding, and it's creating problems.
There should not be feeding
bears. Well, they just shouldn't be feeding the bears. I mean, generally speaking, you know, bird feeding is fine, but when you start feeding mammals, you know, other than maybe throwing a peanut or two to the squirrels, when you start feeding mammals, you start having problems. And mammals have far more potential for causing problems, or in the case of larger mammals, harm, once they're habituated to people. So, you know, I would say you could get some good advice on this and probably some literature to pass on in a friendly way to the neighbors from the USDA Wildlife Services office in Rhinelander. They handle most of the bear problems and therefore have a great deal of experience dealing with this kind of situation. Mm-hmm. So I'd be tempted to give those folks a call and see what they can do to help you out with some literature that talks about the perils of feeding and then go from there.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Can I ask one more question?
Sure.
What can we do with an owl that gets trapped in the chicken coop?
Open the door.
Open the door.
No, I mean, can we actually catch it and move it, like, out of the area?
Well, relocation of birds. I mean, the previous caller was talking about moving coons and rabbits. Relocation of birds is essentially a waste of time because they can beat you back to the release site or to the home. So given the mobility of birds, moving it across the countryside probably isn't going to do you a great deal of good. But I would certainly, if it's caught in the coop, either shoo it out or, you know, carefully throw a net it in a big fishing net or something, or throw a towel or blanket over it so that you're not at risk from the talons, and get it out, disentangle it, let it go. You don't need to worry quite as much about the beak. It's the beak end that most people are concerned about, but it's the talons that'll do the damage. So watch out for the feet. But I think if you, you know, if you put on some protective clothing, football helmet, face mask, hockey gloves, you know, you can go in there and shoo the thing out without even having to handle it.
Okay.
Good luck.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks, Sue. Steve in Milwaukee, up to you now. Hi, Steve.
Hi, great show. I always look forward to our first Wednesday of the month. I'm just kind of wondering if they had a good hatch up north, because we just had a great year last year up in Price County, Sawyer County area, and I was just wondering if the rough grouse had as good a year last year as they, or this year as they did last year, and I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. What about the rough grouse population?
Lots of people are interested in grouse. The season opens in a couple of weekends on the 15th and is a very popular game bird. And I think, as most people realize, they have a cyclic population pattern, in that populations increase to a high point and then drop off for 5 years or so to a low point, and then another 5 years back to a high. The last high was in 99. Last year was a very good year. Populations were up in the 20% range or more. And this year they're up again. Not quite as much, but it was a good hatch. The population is up again. And the speculation is that we're looking at two or three more increasingly good years until we reach a high, and then they'll begin to tail off again. So, yes, if you were happy with last year, you'll be even happier with this year, and next year you'll be beside yourself with excitement. So it should be very good.
Oh, and they're tasty birds. Yes. Oh, I love the taste of rough grouse. Rebecca in Green Bay, hi to you.
Hi, Scott and Larry, I want to thank you for taking my call. We have some property northwest of Crivitz, and over the last several years, the oaks have been dying. So we have the land under management, forestry management, mm-hmm. and they're in the process of harvesting the diseased oaks and the mature pines and popple. But I'm wondering about the pine, the wildlife, the birds, how they're going to fare over these 80 acres of harvested woods, and it's not just ours. It's a large area up there with the dead trees.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, certainly what you do will change the habitat for some species in mm-hmm. a negative way, but it may improve the habitat dramatically for other species. So if there's, you mentioned popple, for example, if there's a few acres of popple cut, that will regenerate or regrow very quickly. And the regeneration or regrowth of popple will mean wonderful habitat for the bird we were just talking about,
rough grouse.
Yeah.
So that could be very beneficial. But realistically, although you can be concerned, I think you have to do what's best for the forest stand. And if eliminating oak wilt or solving that particular disease problem, while you're able to also salvage some financial return from what's left of the oak, you have to do what you have to do from that standpoint. And the popple regeneration may help. They may be able to regenerate oak as part of that cut. Ultimately, the forest regrows. And in the meantime, birds that might be displaced, well, maybe there was a horned owl nesting in the top of one of those big oaks. It's going to move over to the next 40 and find another big oak. It's not just going to stay in place and die. So mm-hmm. I don't think you need to be overly concerned. And in reality, I think once the forestry practices are completed, you'll start to see some species you may not have seen before, and things will be fine.
No?
Okay, thank you.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You know, we got a call from Adrian Whiteven a few minutes ago, and he was calling about the screech supposedly from the fissure.
Okay.
He thought it could be a porcupine, which is a target of the fissure. And porcupines
True.
Do make
They make some really weird noises.
Really, really weird noises. And we might, if I can find a porcupine on here in our CD, I'll take a look and see if we can find one here.
The problem is, if I recall, the caller said this went on most of the night.
That's right.
If it was a fisher attacking a porcupine, it must have been a real stumbling, bumbling fisher to prolong that attack for that long. But certainly a possibility. I've heard porcupines make some really weird sounds. Is there a porky on that?
Yeah, there's a porky on here, and we'll take another call. And okay. while we're doing that, I will see about the porcupine. And the next caller is Ross in Madison. Let me see here. Let me get Ross
And thanks, Adrian, for calling.
Yeah, thanks, Adrian. Appreciate it. Ross in Madison up. Hi, Ross.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Thank you for calling.
Good. What I'm interested in, please, is the pheasant population.
Okay.
For the past 50 years that I've been involved, it's been a constant struggle to maintain the population.
Mm-hmm.
We have, for example, the hatcheries at McKenzie and Poinette and other areas around the state. But you take states, adjacent states like Iowa, I mean, they have tremendous populations of pheasants, and I'm wondering what the problem is.
Well, I think, first of all, in terms of your general question, how are they doing? There are two components to the pheasant situation in Wisconsin as far as pheasant enthusiasts or hunters are concerned. One is the status of the wild population, and overall, that's doing far better than it was not too many years ago, primarily through the amount of acreage put into set-aside programs like the Conservation Reserve Program that have put grass back on the landscape. So whereas back around, say, the early 90s, people were kind of writing pheasants off in southern Wisconsin, they've actually done very well, and there are some pockets of very good pheasant populations. It's my impression that this year's surveys, the rural mail carrier surveys and the pheasant crowing counts, were either flat or even down just a few percentage points. So they're still better than they were years ago, but there was no great pulse in the wild birds this particular year. The other component of the pheasant population is the number of birds being stalked by the Poinette Game Farm, State Game Farm. That was reduced just a few years ago through budget cuts to, I think, only in the neighborhood of 19 or 20,000 birds. Last year, I think it was around 50,000 birds, and this year it's projected to be up around 58,000 birds. So from the standpoint of number of huntable birds put out on public properties throughout southern Wisconsin, the game farm is certainly doing its part, and there'll be lots of stock birds out there for hunters to chase around. The wild birds are doing good, but the basic question, how come we're not as good as
Iowa
or South Dakota or Nebraska, is strictly a matter of habitat. I mean, you look at those states, those are the landscape is vastly different. It is primarily agricultural. There isn't the amount of suburban or urban development. The number of pets and other predators roaming around on the landscape, those states are agriculture for as far as the eye can see. And in many cases, that produces some incredible pheasant populations.
Sure does. Thanks, Ross. Thank you very much for calling. And I think I've got, let's see. I think I've got the possum.
Possum? You mean porcupine?
A porcupine. Wait a second. Did I accidentally think?
It was a Freudian slip, Larry. It happens all the time. Don't worry.
It is porcupine. Okay. I've got the porcupine. Let's listen to that.
North American porcupine.
Yeah.
Sounds a little like a woman screaming.
Yeah.
Well, thanks again, Adrian. That does sound a lot like a woman. You know, but my impression is that sound is not necessarily what we just heard was not necessarily predicated on a predatory experience.
No.
That during the mating season, porcupines make all these bizarre noises and whatnot, communicating with each other. That wasn't necessarily a porcupine in grave distress.
No.
But it sure did sound like a woman screaming to me. So
me too.
Maybe that's what he heard.
Cheryl in Merrill. Your turn. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Yeah, I have a question. I live in the woods, and three of my cats, two of them, it was about 5 or 6 years ago, were severely beaten, and one had part of her flesh ripped off.
Mm-hmm.
And now a month ago, he had a hernia and spinal damage. Of course, they all had to be put to sleep. And I was wondering, what kind of an animal would do this to a cat? Could it be either a fox or a fisher?
Well, it's probably not the fox, but it certainly could be a fisher. Fishers have often been blamed for a variety of depredations on cats. I remember when I used to live in New England, when fishers were first reintroduced, this was 30 or 40 years ago, and there were all sorts of people up in arms that their cats were disappearing. But that doesn't – now, fishers are a possibility, but there's certainly others. Coyotes will certainly take cats as well. But I would think the cat is a little more likely to escape with alive, but with the kind of injuries you're describing from a fisher than from a coyote.
Uh-huh.
And there are probably other possibilities as well, but those are the two at the top of the list.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. And my advice, Cheryl, is your next kitties that you get, make them indoor kitties. You'll solve all the problems that you have had so far with the past three. Rose and Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Rose.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I live right in the central city of Madison. We are being overrun with rabbits, squirrels, and chipmunks.
Yeah.
And what is a humane way of disposing of these critters?
Well, it seems to be a tremendous year for chipmunks, red squirrels,
yeah,
and the like, all over the state. They just seem to be everywhere. Now, for one thing, as we get along toward fall here, these populations will normally begin to decline, and you know, by next spring, things may not be quite as conducive to populations of squirrels and chipmunks and so forth as they are now. So part of it may be grin and bear it for a little while and let winter take its course. The issue of dealing with them depends on what your problem is. If it's a matter of, hey, the squirrels are getting in the soffits of the house or whatnot, then it's a matter of animal-proofing your house. If it's a matter of the animals bothering your perennials or a flower garden or, you know, a couple vegetable plants, then a fence will go a long way toward solving the rabbit problem. So depending on the problem, there are circumstances where you may be able to coexist with the animals by preventing their access. If you feel compelled to remove them, than what we were just talking about a little while ago in the relationship to the rabbits and the raccoons. There are certainly excellent live traps in which you can catch these things and relocate them. But that puts you in the immediate conflict situation again of where do you take them and how many are you going to have to remove? I have a friend who lives near Hilldale, also kind of downtown Madison area, and he's been for many years removing an average of 150 squirrels a year from his backyard.
Huh.
So the point being, it's almost a thinking about removing the things alive is almost a never-ending task. But whether or not you think, if you think, for example, catching chipmunks in a rat trap, which is going to kill them, is inhumane, then that rules that out for you. It is a rather sudden death. If you view sudden death in this case as humane, then that's entirely up to your viewpoint. But what you can't do with any of these animals is think about poisons, especially in an area of high human density where you live, but there are no poisons registered for those animals either. So you're really left with trapping and removing them, either alive or dead, or learning how to live with them through fencing, exclusion, repellents, and those kinds of things.
Yep. Thanks for calling. Patty in Fox Cities, your turn. Hi, Patty.
Hi. I wonder if you could just address quickly some issues concerning the wild rice and the permitting that's required. I wasn't aware of that, and I kayak quite a bit and thought I would perhaps harvest some of this and checked out some stuff online and saw that that's pretty tightly regulated by the DNR and the harvest, the amounts, what lakes you can do it on, et cetera. So.
Mm-hmm. And those regulations, I think, are changing this year with the low water levels.
Yeah,
they're making stricter.
There are some real problems with ricing, especially in the northern part of the state, because some of the rice beds are just dried up and gone. But you're correct. There are permits and regulations that apply. The boat you use has to be a certain width. The sticks you use to harvest the rice, and that's the traditional way to do it, have to be within a certain size parameter. So I'm not sure what you're asking is, Patty, if we think ricing is overregulated, I'd have to say no. I'm sure there's some basis in fact to the regulations in terms of protecting the resource. And if
you're wondering how to do it, or the DNR probably has some information.
There are a whole slew of wild ricing publications available through the DNR as well as the regulations, and I'm afraid that you just have to abide by the regulations. I don't know what else to tell you. It's kind of like needing a hunting license and permits and various things to participate in that.
And it is controlled on all the bodies of water or just the ones that were kind of mentioned and outlined on by county on the website?
That I can't tell you. I think you need to check with the DNR. I think there are cases where there are private lakes or ponds where the rice is semi-cultivated or watched where the landowner has a little more control or say. But I'm not sure about that.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Scott, the bow season starts in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, the 15th of September is a big day with the grouse opener and bow season, and then there are openers in October through about the 20th when the pheasant season opens. And then in the 13th, I think it is, deer hunting in the chronic wasting disease zones, and then the big deer hunting opener on Saturday, the 17th of November. Lots of stuff going on this fall from a hunting theme. And the wildlife populations are in great shape. Should be great.
Thanks, Scott. We'll look forward to our next visit. Appreciate
it. See you in
October. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest. Tomorrow, don't forget, we go to Manitowish Waters to share our enthusiasm for the North Woods and muskie fishing and lake habitat with guests Bill Shearer and Leo Crawley of the World Championship Muskie Classic, guide Joe Booker, and fishing lure creator Ben Hobbins. And I think Joe Booker's also created some lures of his own, too.
I've got
15 or 20 of them in my tackle box right now as we speak. So anyway, come on out to the Manitowish Waters Community Center tomorrow at 11. Join us, and it's a free and open to the public. We'll be doing our show from there. In the meantime, thanks a lot for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.